Haiti's president is assassinated at his home on the outskirts of the capital. The prime minister calls for harmony, but many Haitians are anxious about what comes next. There is a lot of uncertainty.
Everybody regards the president in Haiti as the leader of the country. And we don't have a president. It's like you don't have a state.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, after being hammered by the coronavirus, Brazil may finally be on a better path. Jubilation with vaccines arriving in the country, and why people in Maine are smitten by wooden creatures that have sprung up in the forest.
These are happy, friendly, mystical, magical trolls.
Trolls and the Scandinavian folklore that gave them to us. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. UN Security Council members are planning to gather tomorrow morning for an emergency session on Haiti following the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse last night. A video shows a street outside of his home. Car alarms are going off. And you can see the silhouettes of men with guns standing outside the president's home in the hills of the capital. The attack left the president dead and his wife wounded. Joining us from Port-au-Prince with more is Widlaw Merancourt. He's the editor of the Haitian news outlet, Ayubo Post.
There is a lot of confusion, and it's a tense situation. A lot of confusion because we don't know what happened precisely. You are not seeing a lot of cars in the street. People are trying to figure out what's going on and what will be the next steps. This is basically the situation in Port-au-Prince right now.
As you said, details about the assassination are still unclear. We do know the president was killed in his own home. What have you learned so far?
Today, at 1 a.m., a group of people, heavily armed, entered the personal residence of the president of Haiti, Jovenel Moïse. During this attack, the president was killed and his wife is in critical condition. There is questions with regard to if she will survive. After this attack this morning, the interim prime minister went on TV to explain what happened and to say that the police officers are trying to put the situation under control. There is a lot of questions with regard to who is in charge right now, because this prime minister, Claude Joseph, he resigned and he was replaced right before the president was killed by another prime minister who was supposed to be sworn in the days coming. So you have a vacuum in power. You have a prime minister who is contested, who is trying to comfort everybody. And you have a lot of political actors saying that he don't have this authority to take power.
So President Moïse was elected to a five-year term in 2016. When that term ran out, he began to rule basically by decree and refused to hold elections. You mentioned the vacuum at the top in recent days, Widlaw. Go back a few years, though. Prior to the president's killing, how unstable has Haiti been during his tenure?
During this situation, gangs were controlling large swath of Haiti. Last week, for instance, 20 people were killed, including a high-profile opponent and a Haitian journalist. About 5 journalists were killed during his tenure. Hundreds of people are victims of gang violence. You have thousands of people who in the recent weeks have to flee an area called Martissant because of gangs. These people are in shelters right now. So it was a very tense situation. And with, on top of that, a humanitarian situation, according to the UN, 4.4 million people in Haiti are in need of food. And you have the political situation, the insecurity climate, with this vacuum on top of it, and the humanitarian crisis. It's a very dire situation.
Yeah, a couple of details that I was reading about. There are only 10 elected officials in Haiti, all senators. There isn't even a president of the Supreme Court. He died last week from COVID-19. And then there are the armed gangs you were just talking about, controlling large portions of Haiti's cities. We've spoken with you, Widlaw, in recent months about the trend of kidnappings for ransom. How powerful are these gangs?
Well, these gangs are very powerful. There are reports from several high-profile human rights organizations linking some of them to the president himself. And these people, they are so powerful, they can kill opponents for the president. They parade in the streets with their arms, and the police officers can't do anything because they are more armed than even the police. So it's a situation where you have Jimmy Cherizet, who is the head of G9. The G9 is a coalition of the most powerful gangs in the country. And recently, he held a press conference to announce a revolution. And this revolution he's holding is against, allegedly, the president, even though most people say he's working for the president, and the rich bourgeois in Haiti. And he and his folks, they ransack businesses, they kill people, they conduct massacres in several impoverished areas, including Bel Air, which is a city that is against the power of Jovenel Moïse. So these gangs, they are not here to play, and they are very, very powerful.
Is there concern that these gangs will exploit the current vacuum of power?
It's hard to know, and it's hard to know their motives. It's hard to know if they have any link with regard to what happened. If you see the videos that are being circulated right now, you are hearing people saying, oh, it's an operation by the DEA and things like that. And I had a discussion with someone at the U.S. Embassy, and he told me, and this is the position of the U.S. Embassy in Haiti, that they did not take part of any operation to assassinate the president. It's hard to know who conducted it and the role of the gangs and what will they say. But what we do know is in the future of Haiti, they will have a role to play because they have arms, they are heavily armed, and they are powerful.
Right, back to that main headline. President Moïse now is dead. The president of the Supreme Court, as I said, died of COVID and would have been next in line to the presidency. So who succeeds Moïse now?
Listen, there is nothing in the books with regard to how do you govern a country when every institution was dismantled. You don't have a parliament, you don't have a judicial system, you don't even have police that is functioning properly. When I'm speaking to politicians and actors, what they are telling me is they need to get together to find a solution because there is no legitimate person in the government right now. You have a couple of elected officials in the Senate. They can play a role. I'm hearing that the president of the Senate could be the next president, but how do we know? We don't know because there is nothing in the books for this situation.
Yeah, so these are uncharted waters for Haiti. How do you see what comes next for the country?
We just know that you have a power vacuum and you have a bunch of folks with arms that you see only in films, and you have a national police that cannot do its job, and you have politicians who don't agree with regard to where the country should be going, and you don't have anything on the books with regard to how to handle this situation. So we can hope that politicians will get together and find a solution. We can hope that the international community, the U.S., France, who are very powerful in Haiti, would be able to show some leadership and try to resolve this in a peaceful manner. But how do we know that they will do that? How do we know if they will be able to put everybody on the same room and see what the transition should be?
Widlaw Merancourt is the editor of the Haitian news outlet Ayibo Post, speaking with us from Port-au-Prince about the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. Widlaw, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Preliminary data from Israel this week about the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine is raising questions about how the vaccines continue to work over time with variants like Delta. We asked Dr. Anna Durbin to break all this down with us. She's a professor of international health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and she's been involved in trials of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine. It seems like scientists are learning new things about the Delta variant each and every day, sometimes several times a day. How transmissible is it? What is the current thinking?
So we do know that the Delta variant is much more transmissible, for instance, than the original Wuhan strain that came through. We saw it mutate then to become the Alpha variant, which used to be the UK strain, which was more virulent. So each of these mutations, as the virus is able to find a niche to replicate in, it's the strongest wins. The one that's best at being transmissible is the one that's going to survive. And that's certainly what we're seeing with the Delta variant.
Generally, it's believed that the mRNA vaccines like the Pfizer and Moderna are effective against the Delta variant. But this week, a study in Israel found that Pfizer's shot may not be as effective against this new variant, although it prevents severe illness. What do we know about that?
So, you know, there have been several studies, and I do want to stress that so far all of the vaccines that have been given EUA here in the United States, the mRNA vaccines and the J&J vaccine, and then vaccines that have been given WHO approval, such as the AstraZeneca vaccine, have all shown very high effectiveness against COVID, including the Delta variant. And I think what we have to be careful with is equating, for instance, looking at effectiveness against mild disease versus effectiveness against severe and hospitalized COVID. And we know from studies that have been done in the UK, in particular, and other places, that both the Pfizer vaccine and the AstraZeneca vaccine are highly effective at the prevention of the Delta variant, including, and most importantly, severe disease and hospitalization. So I'm not that concerned about the data coming out of Israel because it showed 93% effectiveness against hospitalization and severe disease. And that's really where our public health impact is.
Is it hard to predict and understand transmission and vaccines and the relationship?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think what people get hung up on is they want complete sterilizing immunity. You know, they want the vaccine to stop the virus from even, you know, replicating or being found in the nose. So to expect a vaccine to provide sterilizing immunity, I think, is unrealistic. What we want to do is prevent people from becoming seriously ill. We want to prevent people from being hospitalized. We want people to be able to go about their day and not lose time due to illness. And the vaccines are highly, highly effective at doing that.
The pace of vaccinating the world does not seem to be keeping up with the spread of this variant.
It is not. It is not.
How has that affected your own understanding of the future of the pandemic and this virus?
Well, it concerns me. You know, we're not going to be free of COVID until the world is free of COVID. And we have to do a better job to be able to ensure that there's vaccine production infrastructure, not just in the United States, not just in Europe, but in areas of the world that currently don't have access to vaccines because they can't produce their own vaccines.
Do you think the virus will mutate faster than those countries can get vaccines? And what does that look like?
I do think we will continue to see evolution and new mutations. I think so far the data are very encouraging in terms of the protection that vaccine induces. Now, will there be a variant that is able to escape, for instance, immunity induced by vaccine and cause more severe disease? You know, I think that that is unlikely. And I say that for two reasons. We always focus on the antibody response to these variants. And, you know, that's how the variants are able sometimes to evade or elude the immune system, because they've made changes in their spike protein. So maybe antibodies don't recognize them as well. And we saw that with some of the monoclonal antibody treatments. But the vaccines, the mRNA vaccines and the adenovirus vectored vaccines, stimulate more than just antibody response. And they stimulate an arm of the immune system that, once you are infected, can clear the virus before you get sick. And that's why I think you're seeing really high effectiveness against severe and hospitalized COVID, where you may be seeing a little bit lower effectiveness against infection, symptomatic infection. The virus is able to get in, but once it's in, your immune system controls it because of the vaccine-induced immunity. So I'm still pretty confident, very confident, that these vaccines are going to be highly effective against severe hospitalized COVID, even by some of these variants.
That is good news.
I hope I'm right.
Dr. Anna Durbin is a vaccine researcher and professor of global health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Durbin, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks so much.
So what does it look like when countries are finally starting to get vaccines in people's arms? We head to Brazil. That's next on the show. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Since the start of the pandemic, we've been reporting on the devastating situation in Brazil. President Jair Bolsonaro either ignored or rejected 14 early offers to purchase vaccine doses, a move, doctors say, that likely increased the death toll by hundreds of thousands of lives. Now Brazil may be on a better path. Only 13% of the population is fully vaccinated, but well over a third of Brazilians have had their first shot. Some cities are pushing for full adult vaccination by the end of August. That's the case in the southern Brazilian state of Florianópolis, where reporter Michael Fox and his wife got their jabs yesterday.
We wake up early, throw the kids in the car, and drive to the old airport. It's not far, maybe 20 minutes. There we slide in line behind a row of vehicles and wait to be vaccinated. It's our turn, age 40 and up, and it's a day for celebration.
Woo-hoo!
As we start to move, we get a call from my wife's mom. She and my wife's dad are about 20 minutes in front of us in line, and they've just gotten their shots, Johnson & Johnson. Both my wife's parents are in their 70s, so they could have been vaccinated months ago, but they were afraid. They didn't know who or what to believe about vaccine safety.
Se você virar o chip, virar o jacaré, é problema de você, pô.
As of late last year, President Jair Bolsonaro was still joking to Brazilians that the vaccines may turn you into a crocodile.
Okay, guys, you ready?
It's almost our turn. A policeman waves us into the loop around the airport.
Oi, tudo bom?
Tudo bom. Vocês dois vão vacinar?
A nurse approaches, green smock, blue surgical face mask. She takes our IDs and proof of residency. The vaccines are being administered by Brazil's universal healthcare system, SUS. They're free, but you can't choose what you get. It just depends on what's arrived. Cars inch forward. On the sidewalk beside us, a row of people in masks wait in a different line for their shots in the walk-in clinic just inside. Before we know it, it's our turn. Words alone can't describe what this means. Like everyone, we've had a hard year and a half. We've been really isolated. My wife came down with the virus in March of 2020. It turned into a thyroid issue she's still battling. More recently, she lost her grandmother and an uncle to COVID-19. A quick shot, and it's over. Our kids film us from the back seat. Spontaneous celebrations from the people in the cars beside us. We join in. I look into my wife's eyes, and past the face mask and plastic surgical goggles she's wearing, I see something I haven't for a long time. It's the same thing pouring from the cars as we drive home, vehicles in a line now backed up for miles. I see hope, something Brazilians haven't had for a long time. For the World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Turning now to the upcoming Tokyo Olympics, American track and field athlete Sha'Carri Richardson has been completely banned from competition after she tested positive for marijuana use. Richardson was considered a favorite in the women's 100-meter race. The ban opened a debate over whether athletes should be allowed to compete while using marijuana. To understand the drug's impact on athletes, we turn to Dr. Michael Joyner. He's a physician and researcher on exercise physiology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Joyner, is pot a performance-enhancing substance? What have you found as to its effects on athletes?
Marco, I went and looked at the medical literature on this topic last week on PubMed, the National Medical Library, which is online, and really couldn't find any evidence it's performance-enhancing at all. Specifically, no evidence it's performance enhancing in a sport like sprinting or anything that would be what we think about, you know, faster, higher, stronger in terms of the Olympics. Now, there is some concern it might be useful in sports that require relaxation like shooting or archery, but again, not much has been proven there at all. So you can't really find any evidence it's performance enhancing.
So explain then how Olympic officials view cannabis and what their relationship is to the role of the World Anti-Doping Agency. What exactly are the rules and who sets them?
Well, WADA sets the rules, but you know, the rules are set by committees, by groups, by bureaucracies. And these people don't live in a vacuum. So as the rules emerged in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, people that felt marijuana was a drug of abuse got that banned as well as performance-enhancing drugs. So the code includes things that have at one time or could currently be seen as drugs of abuse by some people. Because again, you have to satisfy a lot of masters when you're making these sorts of regulations.
So in your opinion, are the Olympics and the World Anti-Doping Agency kind of viewing cannabis in the wrong kind of frame?
Well, I think if their goal is to stop performance-enhancing drugs, have clearly missed the bus, at least from an evidence point of view in terms of cannabis. And I think then they have to have a larger discussion based on societal trends about how people are now beginning to view marijuana over the last 10 or 20 years.
I mean, right now, though, athletes sign up knowing that these are the rules. How long have athletes pushed back against the pot ban, and why do you think a lot of questions are being raised now?
Oh, I think the reason questions are being raised now is several fold. One is the obvious example of Miss Richardson, this very unfortunate example of a really gifted and superior athlete who'd worked so hard not being able to go to the Olympics. So I think that's one reason you have a kind of a case. I think you have these societal changes. As somebody pointed out, marijuana is legal, or at least not criminal, in Oregon, where the Olympic trials were in Eugene. And then I think you see changes in the way things are dealt with by the professional leagues, who are not necessarily under the WADA code, but nevertheless have regulate drug use by their athletes.
So it's interesting. Major League Baseball took marijuana off its banned substances list a couple of years ago. The NBA has suspended its random testing of players for pot. So just how uniform are the rules on cannabis when you look at different sports?
Well, when you get to different sports, you have to recognize with the professional leagues, this is a labor management issue, and what's banned, how long things or how often people are tested and so forth, what the substances are. And just the entire list is subject to kind of labor management negotiations. So it's in their contracts, as opposed to WADA, which is an international federation or an international organization, which tries to come up with a consensus list. And then that list is used by a whole bunch of other sporting federations. So the use of the WADA list is not uniform, and it's not used by professional baseball or several other professional sports in the United States.
Is there inconsistency in other sports in other countries?
I would assume there is inconsistencies in other sports in other countries. And I think it all depends on who or if the sport or league follows the WADA code or if they have their own.
And right now, how do you think we should view these Olympic rules? Is it their games, their rules, or do you think they're out of date?
Oh, I think these folks don't live in a social vacuum. And I think that as these large-scale trends that you described continue to occur, they'll revisit the banning of cannabis.
Dr. Michael Joyner, physician and researcher on exercise physiology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, speaking with us about the Olympics ban on marijuana. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You can catch up with some of the stories our correspondents have been reporting in case you missed them, from Peru's presidential elections with no official winner declared yet, to the problems with an immigration program for Liberians in the U.S., and everything you need to know about a special cheese from the Turkish city of Van. Find those stories and more at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. In May, a bombing in Afghanistan left nearly 100 people dead, including children. One father is still searching for his daughter. We believe she is still alive, he says. Tragedy and hope in Afghanistan, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. All this week, we're examining big themes in American security, defense, and how the U.S. uses its power around the world. Our guide is Lacey Healy with the PRX National Security Podcast, Things That Go Boom. Today, we're focused on one woman.
Barbara Lee, 13th Congressional District of California.
Representative Lee was in the Capitol building on September 11th, 2001. She was evacuated as the terror attacks were unfolding. She remembers trying to run down the street that day in high heels. Fast forward almost 20 years to January 6th of this year. Lee was again in the Capitol building, but this time she was prepared.
I had been watching and reading what some of the really white supremacist right-wing groups had been talking about, what they planned. Secondly, I had heard what Donald Trump had said, not just that day, but over the years, in terms of his hostile rhetoric and inciting violence and what have you. And in my mind, the night before, I put all of this together and decided that I was going to wear my tennis shoes because I assumed something was going to go down.
And as we know, something did. Those events, January 6, 2021, and September 11, 2001, they bookend 2 decades of counterterrorism and forever wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Today, Lacey Healy brings us her conversation with Representative Barbara Lee about the lessons we are still learning on how to restrain military power.
If you've heard of Representative Barbara Lee before, it's probably from that time when she learned not to wear high-heeled shoes.
A plane has just crashed into the World Trade Center here in New York City.
That just exploded.
We just saw another plane coming in from the side.
And there is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon. Oh, my goodness.
Well, I said earlier that I was in the Capitol when we thought Flight 93 was coming in and had to evacuate. And so for me, it was a very harrowing moment, like none other. And my chief of staff, actually, his cousin was Wanda Green. She was on Flight 93 as a flight attendant. So the horrific events of 9/11 hit me personally also.
The attack was the worst ever on American soil. And President George W. Bush wanted to send a strong message of unity for whatever came next. He had the authority to act by himself in an emergency like this, an actual attack on the United States. But he wanted Congress on his side, since technically, the Constitution grants Congress the sole power to declare war. So the White House came up with a joint resolution and sent it over to Capitol Hill, an authorization for the use of military force, or AUMF. And basically, an AUMF is the next step down from a formal declaration of total war. The last declaration of war that we issued was in World War II. The wars in Vietnam, the Persian Gulf, Afghanistan, and Iraq, those were all AUMFs.
But when I read the resolution, it was overly broad. It was 60 words, and it, in essence, said the president can use force anytime he or she wants to use force, period.
Specifically, it says, quote, that the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, or committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001. And it applies as long as the intent is to prevent future acts of international terrorism against the United States, which seemed like a lot of authority. Even as Lee herself mourned the losses suffered on 9/11, she struggled with this.
So I was as sad and as angry and thought we needed to do something, but what I did not know, but I knew one thing, and that was violence begets violence, and I did not want to see us become, quote, the evil that we deplore.
So September 14th rolls around, the day of the vote, and Lee makes a snap decision to go to the memorial service being held at the National Cathedral.
I finally decided to go at the last minute. I was with Elijah Cummins in the cloakroom, our beloved Elijah. And I said, no, Elijah, I think I'm going to go. And I ran down the steps and got on the bus. I think I was the last person.
We are here in the middle hour of our grief. So many have suffered so great a loss.
You know, the service was part memorial, but a lot of what some of the speakers put forth at the service really was sort of a warlike message.
Our responsibility to history is already clear: to answer these attacks and rid the world of evil. This conflict was begun on the timing and terms of others. It will end in a way and at an hour of our choosing.
But then the Nathan Baxter, who was head of the cathedral, in his sermon, he said,
that as we act,
let us not become the evil we deplore.
We not become the evil we deplore.
I said, no, I can't do this. So I decided at that moment that I was not going to vote for any authorization that gave any president, Democrat or Republican, the authority to use force in perpetuity. And that was a hard decision. And so I went back to the Capitol and went to the floor and gave my speech.
Mr. Speaker, members, I rise today really with a very heavy heart. One that is filled with sorrow for the families and the loved ones who were killed and injured this week.
And I voted against it.
Some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute. and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control.
She was the only no vote in both chambers.
Believe you me, after that, all hell broke loose. Death threats, harassment, people coming after me.
Lee's office was inundated with hate mail. She was accused of helping the Taliban, and she had to have a security detail around the clock.
It was a terrible, terrible moment for me, but I knew I had to stand firm and really understand that I was not going to be part of giving an unconstitutional authorization to any president to put our troops in harm's way when we didn't know what we were doing. No end date, no exit strategy. My dad, I'm a military brat. My dad was retired as a lieutenant colonel in the Army. My dad fought in World War II and Korea. He was the first one to call me and told me that was the right vote. He said, I'm so proud of you.
Of course, Lee's fears came to pass. Over the past 20 years, the AOMF has been stretched to hand the president wider and wider authority. It's been used as the justification to attack not just the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, but also ISIS and quote-unquote associated forces around the globe, even including airstrikes on Libya in 2016. If you've ever been watching the news and thought, wait, we're conducting drone strikes where?
A U.S. drone in Somalia has killed one of the world's most wanted terrorists.
There are how many prisoners still in Guantanamo?
American taxpayers are spending more than $7 million per detainee every year.
You are probably seeing the AUMF at work.
We had the Congressional Research Service do a study for us, declassified report. And a couple of years ago, it had been used, I believe, 41 times in about 18 or 19 countries. Yemen, Somalia, domestic spying here, all over the world. Not related at all to 9/11.
20 years after her solitary descent, thousands of U.S. troops have been killed or gravely wounded or come home with PTSD. U.S. airstrikes have unintentionally killed scores of civilians, an Iraqi journalist, a family driving to the hospital, an Afghan wedding party. The so-called forever wars have less and less support.
And so it's a quagmire, and we've got to really begin to unravel all of the impacts of what has happened as a result of the Iraqi and Afghanistan wars. I mean, I'm not saying we should just abandon these countries because, you know, we've created havoc in many ways. So we have a responsibility to help them, but not get involved in any more civil wars.
You might also argue that there are hard lessons we have yet to learn from our response to 9/11 that could inform how we deal with the fallout from January 6th. President Biden tapped a distinguished veteran of the post-9/11 intelligence security apparatus, Russ Travers, to serve as his deputy Homeland Security advisor, turning his skills in rooting out foreign terrorists to rooting out domestic terrorists. But Lee is worried that if we rush to expand domestic security authorities while we're still smarting from the Capitol siege, the way we did for international terror threats after 9/11, we'll be headed down another troubled path, inviting another overreach of power. Actually, the last thing I wanted to ask you is just that this is a very hard time for our country. I'm sure it's a very hard time for you as an elected leader, and you clearly lean deeply into your faith. Is there anything that you're turning to now that's giving you hope, a sermon, a song?
First of all, the light always outshines the darkness, okay? Then there's a scripture, it's 2 Timothy. Verses 1-7. And it says, for God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And so, yes, I'm a person of faith and I understand the threats that are out there. And I know we have to be careful and we have to do everything we can do because white supremacy and systemic racism is in the DNA. Of this country. So while we have to deal with the threats and address domestic and international terrorism, we can't do this with a sense of fear. It keeps you from moving forward. It stops you. It makes you retreat. And then who wins? They win. And so people have to understand the reaction has got to be of a sound mind, but not let fear overtake us.
That was Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat from California, speaking with Lacey Healy for the PRX National Security Podcast, Things That Go Boom. The story was produced by Ruth Morris and Robin Wise. Tomorrow, in the conclusion of our series, how climate change itself is a global security threat. One person's trash is another person's treasure, so the saying goes. This is the story of a Danish artist who has applied that concept around the globe with some curious mascots, giant trolls. The world's Bianca Hillier has their story.
The coastal Maine Botanical Gardens stretch over more than 300 acres along the New England shore. Hundreds of thousands of visitors explore the wooded grounds every year. And this season, five new guests are calling the gardens home.
These are happy, friendly, mystical, magical trolls.
Gretchen Oster is the president and CEO of the gardens. She says these trolls are part of an exhibit called Guardians of the Seeds. They're made of recycled wood, and they don't look like gnomes or little creatures who scamper through the forest. For one thing, they're huge.
They're the size of, you know, the room that you're sitting in, or like a small house even. They are larger than life. I think the tallest one here is 25 feet tall. Standing next to them, you don't even go up to the kneecap on the ones that are standing.
Some are standing, but one troll is sitting cross-legged in a seemingly meditative state. Another smiles as it stretches its arms high in the air toward the treetops. If you can't quite picture these otherworldly figures, check out photos on our Twitter. We're at The World. You'll see that the staggering structures are stunning, but there's a story behind their beauty. With roots in Scandinavian folklore, these trolls have emerged from the ground to watch over the Maine forest. That's according to Danish artist Thomas Dambo, who wrote the story behind the trolls. It was told that the trolls spoke the tongue of the trees and had sworn to protect them from war and disease, Dambo writes. But when they sprung above ground, they discovered they had to protect the forest from humans, too. The story continues. Little people came plenty across and over the seas to cut, fell, and break down tree after tree after tree. Dambo says trolls have long been used in Scandinavian folklore to explain what humans may not understand.
Back in the days, you would use the different trolls and different types of creatures to try and explain some of the things you couldn't understand, like, oh, why is there thunder now? Why is there drought? Or what's happening? So now I try to use my troll and to put everything into perspective. They're the representatives of the forces of nature.
Dambo began this work in 2014 and has since built 80 trolls across three continents, from Belgium to South Korea to Puerto Rico.
All my art is about preserving nature, taking care of nature, getting people out into nature, getting people to reconnect with nature.
In each location, he sifts through heaps of trash and recycling to find materials for the project. It's a practice that's been important to him since he was young.
When I was a kid, my favorite thing was to go with my friends into a dumpster, scavenge some nice materials, go into the forest, build a treetop house, and then have fun doing it, you know? So basically, that's still what I'm doing.
As for his new work in Maine, each of the five trolls represents different parts of a tree. The root, trunk, branch, leaf, and flower. Dambo says it took more than 7 weeks for a team of people to construct the faces in Denmark and then build the bodies in the States. Wells Moore was one of the 150 community volunteers who helped erect the structures.
I worked on what they call the Gro. He's the leaf troll, and it is definitely Scandinavian. There's no doubt about it. We don't really have anything like it here in the States, and I think that may be one of the reasons that they've gone over so well.
Moore lives on an island near the gardens and has volunteered there for more than 2 decades. He's not a carpenter by trade, but said the task was simple enough under the guidance of Dambo's team. The engineering and artistry impressed him, but what Moore finds most valuable about the trolls is what they teach kids.
There are trees, the chestnut tree and the elm tree. Those are virtually gone extinct. And it's vitally important for the younger generation to understand that they can't take them for granted, that they are in danger. So I think the troll is a wonderful messenger for that story.
Gretchen Oster says the magical, healing nature of the trolls is especially welcome this year as the gardens open and people return to somewhat normal life.
We've always said that the gardens are a healing place, and now I feel like the giant trolls are just adding to that.
Oster says the trolls will stick around the gardens for up to 10 years, or for as long as we humans need reminders to take care of nature around us. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is moving quickly. According to the Pentagon, it's already more than 90% complete. After decades of war, President Biden says it's now up to Afghans to build their own future. Peace seems out of reach, though. The Taliban offensive against Afghan government forces is also accelerating, and in the midst of it all are people like the man at the center of our next story, a father whose life was turned upside down by tragedy. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
For the past 2 months, Abdullah Ahmadi has been trying to answer one question. What happened to Shukriya, his 19-year-old daughter? I've been searching nonstop, he tells me over the phone from Kabul, for anything, a piece of her clothing, a notebook, her backpack, something that might tell me what happened to her. Ahmadi's daughter has been missing since May 8th. That's when 3 bombs exploded at a girls' school in Kabul, killing at least 100 people and injuring many more. Ahmadi was at home that day, asleep. It was Ramadan and he was fasting. His phone rang and a man on the line said, "There's been an explosion at his daughter's school." He jumped up and rushed to the scene. There, he says, he found a large crowd. People were loading the injured into cars and speeding them off to nearby hospitals. Ahmadi looked everywhere. No sign of Shukriya. So he figured someone must have taken her to the hospital. He searched for hours, hospital after hospital, clinic after clinic. Nothing. I saw many dead and injured people, he says. It's like my daughter just vanished. Shukriya's story got a lot of attention from Afghanistan's news media in the days after the attack. Reporters went to Ahmadi's home and interviewed him. Newspaper headlines asked in bold, "Where is Shukriya?" But recently, that coverage has shifted to news about the U.S. withdrawal and the Taliban's rapid advance. Meanwhile, families of the victims of the May explosions are left without answers. An all too familiar story after decades of war in Afghanistan. Ali Saadat was among the first people on the scene at the school that day. He's with a network of volunteers in Kabul who show up in the aftermath of attacks to help. Saadat has been doing this work for the past decade, he says. He's 31 years old. He knows how dangerous this work is. Sometimes insurgents plant secondary bombs with the goal of killing emergency workers. Saadat says despite all the ugliness of this war, he wants to show that Afghans have not lost their humanity. Saadat has also been helping Shukriya's father look for his daughter. He thinks she could be alive, given that they haven't found her remains. There's also some CC camera footage that shows a patient who looks like Shukriya getting treatment at a hospital. Problem is, she was transferred to another hospital, and no one knows what happened to her after that. Afghan officials appear to be moving on. The Ministry of Health did not respond to my request for an interview. After almost 2 months of searching, Shukriya's father says he is exhausted, but he's not giving up. He still shows up at government offices every day to ask for updates. Mostly, he leaves without any new information. Ahmadi says his daughter had big dreams. She wanted to go to university. She wrote poetry and loved to draw. As we talk, her sister, Fatima, jumps on the call and says she wants to read some of Shukriya's poems. It's about the beauty of this world, full of life and optimism. Fatima is 2 years younger. She went to the same school. The day of the attack, she stayed home because she was sick. Shukriya and I are very close, she says. I miss her every day. Fatima says she plans to be back at school when it reopens. She's worried about more attacks as the Taliban continue to advance. The Ahmadis have even more to fear. They are members of the Hazara community, an ethnic group in Afghanistan that has been under constant threat by the Taliban and the so-called Islamic State. But Ahmadi says he wants his 3 daughters to continue their education. And he includes Shukriya because he has no doubt that she's still alive. They will go to school even if the Taliban comes back, he says. I will make sure of that. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Along the French Riviera stands a giant convention center. It hosts all kinds of gatherings, but the most famous is the Cannes Film Festival. Normally, during the pandemic, the convention center became a mass vaccination site. But last night, the Cannes Film Festival and the red carpet were back. Things are different. There are fewer people. Organizers are requiring masks and discouraging the famous French greeting, a kiss on both cheeks. But there were plenty of smiles on the red carpet and some kisses, despite the warnings. The influence of the pandemic is felt in the films. French director Catherine Corsini filmed La Fracture, or The Divide, during the pandemic. It takes place in a hospital. On set last fall, Corsini told Euronews about the challenges COVID presented. COVID, it's so anti-cinematographic, she said. It's against everything I love, to hug, to talk, that the actors can see your expressions. This year, the festival is debuting a new section for films about climate. One is Above Water, a French documentary that follows a girl in Niger who must walk miles each day for water. In one scene, the girl fills her bucket and asks, "Is that all the water we got?" One last note, there is no virtual component to the Cannes Film Festival this year. Everything is old-fashioned, butts in seats, movie-going. After a year of watching films on small screens at home, there's something refreshing and hopeful about that. And that's going to do it for us on this Wednesday. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here. We'll see you again tomorrow.